Welcome back, everyone. This is Ryan Selkis. You're listening to another episode of Messari's Unqualified Opinions, where each week I discuss key industry trends with crypto's top investors, builders, and thinkers. Just a reminder, Messari is much more than a podcast company. So if you're an industry professional or crypto investor, head over to Messari.io and check out Messari Pro, our crypto toolkit that offers best-in-class research, advanced screening, and charting tools to keep you ahead of the investing curve, plus a new enterprise alerts tool. We're also hosting the industry's largest virtual event, the Mainnet, this June 1st through 3rd, with over 50 hours of programming, 100 confirmed speakers, and virtual networking that's so seamless, you'll feel like you're actually there. 50% of the profits are heading to COVID relief, so go reserve your spot today at mainnet.events. That's Messari.io for pro research and tools, and mainnet.events for the best virtual event you'll attend this year. With that, strap in for another episode. Going to be a good one. This episode of the podcast brought to you by Luca. Save money this tax season with Luca Tax, the only time-tested crypto tax software. Luca has listened to your feedback and now lets you calculate capital gains and losses, seeing the results using three different accounting methods side by side, all for free. You only pay if you want to see their detailed tax reports and submit your forms using their software. Luca supports unlimited transaction downloads from all major exchanges and wallets and helps you optimize your tax reporting so you can max out this year's refunds or minimize how much you have to pay. Luca wants to help Messari's Unqualified Opinions listeners save even more this year. So use promo code MESSARITAX and you'll get a discount. Much more importantly, you'll do your taxes correctly and stay out of jail. Download Luca Tax at Luca with two Ks, tax.com, and save money this tax season. This episode is brought to you by Bitstamp, the original crypto exchange. 2011 is a long time. This is their third Bitcoin halving, and Bitstamp has been the preferred exchange for serious traders and investors all along the way. 4 million customers, including top financial institutions worldwide, use Bitstamp. Check them out because they've got some serious professional-grade trading technology, including a matching engine from NASDAQ, some of the best APIs in the industry, and TradeView, their advanced trading interface, includes live charting and deep analytical tools that are available on web and mobile. Bitstamp also delivers unmatched customer service, no robots, real live people around the clock via phone, email, and social media if you have issues, but you won't. Join over 4 million traders, download the Bitstamp app from the App Store and Google Play, or visit bitstamp.net/pro to get started. That's bitstamp.net/pro, and they're hooking you up with a discount for Messari Pro as well using promo code Bitstamp. This episode of the podcast brought to you by Crypto.com. We know times are tough. That's why Crypto.com is introducing three different measures to help its community with their new Crypto.com app and credit card. First, they're waiving 3.5% credit card fee on all crypto purchases in the next 3 months. They're also offering 10% back when you use the MCO Visa card on food and grocery shopping. And as always, you can buy gift cards on the Crypto.com app for merchants like Whole Foods, Safeway, Burger King, and more, with 20% back on food and an additional 10% back on groceries. So download the Crypto.com app today.
This podcast is presented by Blockworks Group, one of the top blockchain events and media production companies I've worked with. For exclusive content and events that could help you with insight into the crypto and blockchain space, check them out at blockworksgroup.io, and you will not be disappointed.
What's up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of Messari's Unqualified Opinions. I'm Ryan Selkis, at 2-Bit Idiot. Haven't caught up with my friend Mason Borda in a while. He is the co-founder and CEO of Tokensoft. He was actually one of the original guinea pigs for Unqualified Opinions. Back when we were doing it on this little spindly iPhone stand that we were balancing up against a whiteboard in our WeWork, and it was literally just the most bootstrapped junior varsity test case for this podcast. But it ended up being a very, very fun conversation. And at least now—
It was a good setup.
You sitting side by side. Yeah. wearing the swag, of course. Do you want to explain why your hat is such a perfect brand piece of collateral for Tokensoft, because of how it subtly hints at so many of the problems that you guys are solving?
Yeah. So at Tokensoft, we started out to help companies issue security tokens, whether they're enterprises, they are asset managers, or they're financial institutions and banks. And so if you're going to invest in securities offerings in the US, and let's say they're private offerings, they're not like IPOs, you need to be what is called a credit investor. And so one of the primary things that our website does is it checks for investors and makes sure that they're accredited before coming into the website. And so we thought, it's a lot of work to become a credit investor. You have to have certain net worth, and you have to go through all these hoops to have a lawyer review your bank information. So why don't we just give everyone the experience of being an accredited investor? And so that's why we made these hats that says accredited investor on it. So now everyone can have the experience.
And all you need to do is take a selfie and submit it with your social security number and your driver's license. And voila, you can participate in some of these offerings now.
That's right. We also have a fanny pack. So if you go to shop.tokensoft.io, you can order a Cred Investor fanny pack. So you can hold your driver's license, passport, and $250,000. Or sorry, it's your W-2 showing you have $250,000 in annual salary or $1 million. And so the fanny pack is the perfect tool for keeping all that information together.
Nice. Sounds like a must have. So Mason, speaking seriously, last time we talked was almost 18 months ago. How has the security token landscape changed? How do you view the world of infrastructure and compliance tools in that realm? And are we getting closer to actually seeing anything actually hit escape velocity when it comes to security tokens or regulated tokens that require transfer agents, that require providers like TokenSoft to facilitate and kind of grease the wheels here?
Yeah, so one of the biggest issues I think with security tokens is multifaceted. So one was a lot of people were perceiving security tokens from sort of an ICO lens. And it's very different. It's actually the polar opposite of that. It's better to approach it from a traditional lens. So with a lot of the tech that's out there, it's still tech that's designed for cryptocurrencies and not for security tokens. And so that's one like fundamental issue in the space. The other is just lack of infrastructure. Because everyone is coming up from it from that lens, it made it harder to figure out like what's the right infrastructure that actually fits in the security token space. And that's just traditional infrastructure that's sort of mapping out into the blockchain. A lot of people bring up the question, if you're doing that, what are the benefits of actually putting this on the blockchain? And so there's definitely a lot of benefits that I'll talk about in a little bit, but those are the sort of major detractions to the space that slowed it down a lot. I think, since we're one of the first companies to get set up with a broker dealer in the space, then we got a transfer agent as well to be able to service registered offerings. And so as you can see, like if you're looking at it from a cryptocurrency lens, you just need a money transmitter license or you need a trust license. And now you can do everything. Everything's like vertically integrated. You're an exchange, you can do custody, you can do trading, and you're doing compliance in the front. But in the security space, the way the licenses work and just due to the level of checks and balances, to be able to do a full exchange, you need to partner with like 3 to 5 different companies that have the different licenses to fit those different parts. So ATSs, for example, don't have custody. They're supposed to use a separate custodian to custody the assets. And that's just part of the checks and balances that come into play in the space no one on Wall Street can trust each other, and that's why there's so much licensing in the security space. One example is we're doing a two of our customers. One is doing a IPO as an F1 offering. They're called INX, and so we've had to put up a bunch of infrastructure for that. And there's another registered offering we're doing as well. That's structured as an N2 offering. And that one's for a regulated treasury-backed stablecoin. And so you want to like set up this thing, but like you need all these like pieces to be able to play in this sandbox of public regulated securities. And so who's going to do custody? Who's going to do allow for trading like in a marketplace or for transfers in a marketplace? And what are all the pieces that you need? And so one thing we rolled out for that is a big question was custody. A lot of people were trying to use MetaMask and shoehorn crypto into security. So we launched TokenSoft investment accounts. So now you can hold security tokens without holding Ether. and it's still completely user-owned where they have a majority of the keys. And so I think the industry is getting there. The major blocker is still custody. There's still no SEC or FINRA regulated custodian in the space. And I think once you have that, then the industry will flourish. The exchanges will get a little bit louder. But we're almost there.
How long do you think that's, and when you say there's no regulated custodian, that's for all of crypto, or you're speaking specifically for
securities,
security tokens, right? Yeah, because you've got like trust company structures, you know, in Gemini and Paxos and a couple of others in New York. Yeah. But that's for crypto assets and currencies, which would be more under the CFTC purview.
Yeah. If you look overseas, though, if you look at the partnership with TokenSoft International AG and Seba Bank, they do have a full, in Switzerland, FINMA granted two licenses for full crypto licenses or for full crypto activities. So custody, securities dealer licensing. And so the licensing there is a little bit more robust than what you see in the U.S., where it's very fragmented. So that's one dynamic that we're noticing internationally is they're a little bit faster with the licensing than they are in the U.S. due to the fragmented nature.
You know, one thing that is typical in crypto, it's very atypical in the traditional realm, is how liquidity is pooled across multiple exchanges. And that, I think, presents a ton of securities token challenges in terms of their interoperability across jurisdiction. How have you thought about the challenges of connecting the pipes between Coinbase or a security token exchange in the U.S.? I'm assuming that Coinbase will have those capabilities when they become feasible and interesting, versus a European exchange versus an Asian exchange. Any of the traditional platforms through which you'd actually want to trade crypto assets. And, with all the restrictions that these specific tokens have and some of the liquidity issues that persist because you're, unlike NASDAQ or NYSE, the shares of stock are not all concentrated on one exchange.
Yeah. So I think from my perspective, the biggest value is the interconnectivity. And that's where we're going to realize the real efficiencies in terms of transfers and liquidity internationally. So to answer your question, in the U.S., it depends on the licensing. So to the extent the licensing there is there, then we can definitely connect. I think there's a few parties in the U.S. that are still operating in a very proprietary way. And so that's sort of going to be a roadblock. And like everyone is going to have to open up if they do want to actually have these tokens trade on multiple venues and to move around and transfer in different technologies. They will have to operate in a less proprietary way. And that's one thing I hope becomes more normal. And so once you have that interconnectivity between the U.S. and different like venues internationally, now you have like a globally connected stock market. And I think that's like the cool like end vision with security tokens is that connectivity. In terms of compliance, now you don't have to spend, like 4 weeks onboarding a fund, or you don't have to have a bunch of lawyers vetting a trade before it happens if it's in the private markets. With things like ERC 1404, you can just do a check to see if these trades are authorized or not authorized. And if they're authorized, they just go through. The requisite paperwork is signed. But the legal review isn't necessary to reinterpret, what is the security and can it actually transfer between this person and the other. So I think you'll probably see DeFi and security tokens merging a little bit in terms of the end vision and goal. But I think like people just have to get over this regulatory hump to get there.
You mentioned programmatic stablecoins. So I want to come back to that and don't think I didn't forget. We're in this negative interest rate environment right now. And I think the question that that's on my mind, I'm sure it's on a lot of other people's minds, what's going to happen to all these stablecoin issuers whose very business models are dependent on a positive rate environment? And you know, you obviously, I think, have some pretty strong opinions on this, but I am struggling to see a future state in, you know, the near or medium term, which is really the only time that's relevant in you know, crypto terms, where the traditional or kind of early stablecoin model is feasible.
And when you say early stablecoin model, are you referring to
just the one that we've seen so far, right? Where the float is, or the assets under management are reinvested, and the issuer is able to sweep the interest to the, you know, either themselves or the other token holders.
Yeah, I think what we're going to realize, like, in 5 years is there were a lot of like hacks to get this stuff up and running, and they don't necessarily like work in different environments. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, the first thing when the COVID stuff started happening for me was like, okay, well, what's going to happen to these stable coins that are custodying traditional like trust accounts or with money transmitters that are actually collateralized? And so, and naturally my mind went towards like bank runs. And so what happens if you're holding like USDC or Gemini dollar? Not to bash on them, but from a infrastructure perspective, what if there's a bank run? Like, are those the last out or are they the first out? And if you're trying to pull money out of like a crypto like exchange or bank, I think that's a lot harder than pulling cash out or doing it digitally through your bank. And so like once you start to go through that, okay, so what's the alternative to that? That's the algorithmic stable coins. And so for those, like, those actually have some resiliency because they're completely decoupled to the traditional banking systems. And so whatever you think of the regulatory side of things, that resiliency actually lives. So if you think about it, like, it's closer to the decentralized ethos of Bitcoin and Ethereum. And that's what naturally provides its resiliency, like, fundamentally. And then what happens when interest rates go negative? So we did some like thinking and planning around this for negative interest environments at TokenSoft. And so if you actually want to put negative interest rate currencies on the blockchain, you're going to have to either charge a large fee or pull money out of accounts. So just like mass burning coins. So like, let's say there's 10 wallets, they each have $10 and you would have to like mass burn like $1 out of each one of those to be able to pay for the negative interest rates. And so you're going to have mechanisms like that. And that's where like decentralized stable coins are kind of interesting because they have the resilience where no one can start to zap your money away theoretically and ideally. and so that's sort of been interesting in this environment is the decentralized tool or the decentralized like currencies actually do live on. And the interest rates we've been getting from like DeFi type stuff, like, is that going to last or does that go negative as well? I think is a good question.
If you think about like the real world, I think finance starts to break down in general when interest rates go negative. If that happens in DeFi, I have no idea how DeFi persists in a negative rate environment. We're going to find out soon enough, but, do you think one of the more promising projects in the stablecoin space was Basis and Basecoin when they launched and raised a ton of money from who's who of investors, and they had this programmatic central bank that, so it was algorithmically generated and supposed to be stabilizing around a peg through this seniorage shares model that they had. If some of the tools that have been built in the last 18 months were around back in December of 18, I think it was when they shut down, do you think it would be a different story? And do you think that a project like that could come to market with a very similar structure today, but using slightly different tools and securities token framework maybe to facilitate the seniorage shares? Or was that concept just dead in the water? And maybe just explain a little bit the structure of these tokens.
Yeah. So my impression of Basis when I first read the white paper, without like knowing anything about what was going on with the fundraising or anything like that, was it was a little bit too similar to traditional banking. And I think I don't see that. I never saw that as a value add. And so, like, why would you basically take traditional systems and plug them into smart contracts to try to create a decentralized like system? And so like, it was a little bit of a, like, it didn't quite like make sense. It was sort of like an oxymoron like project. I think looking at it like again, it's hard to see if it would actually be resilient in this environment or if it would actually mimic the negative like interest rates. And I think that's why like full, like you should either be like fully decoupled or fully like coupled. Like security tokens, like right now they have to be fully coupled and work backwards from traditional banking because they have to fit into the regulated environment. And then we'll figure out what we can decentralize later. ERC 1404 is actually designed to be decentralized to the extent possible. And so there's no compatibility issues. Anyone can go and use it. There's a lot of projects out there that are just innovating on it. But with like stable coins, anything that's supposed to be fully decentralized, you probably want to stay as far on that extreme as possible. Bitcoin did that really well. ICOs did that worse. And so there were a lot of issues with that. And so I think the closer you can stay on that sort of ideal extreme of decentralization, the better. I don't think a lot of people value like how much thinking Satoshi did in terms of making sure Bitcoin was as decentralized as possible. So number one, he was anonymous, so no one to go after. Number two, the network is actually pretty, well, it was decentralized, like more decentralized at the beginning, but it's decentralized to the extent possible. And all of those things that he did provide a lot of resiliency from like a regulatory perspective. And so I think that's one issue I'm seeing is like some people are too far in the middle. They need to start on one extreme or the other before they can sort of land in the middle.
Mm-hmm. I guess the other part of your business, which maybe is like an unspoken and more, you know, bespoke type of services, is just thinking about how you can retroactively bring some projects back into the light, or at least into the good graces of regulators, if they deem that something is actually a security ex post facto. And you know, many of these we kind of knew about in advance, and it's just the legal process kind of running its course. But I think it's probably top of mind for a lot of people today. You look at a project like Telegram and their Telegram Open Network, which finally, I think we've seen the last nail in the coffin with news. We're talking Tuesday, the 12th. And just earlier today, the founder of Telegram essentially said, Pavel Durov said, you know, we're not going to actually be able to go through this project, not only in the U.S., but because the U.S. has such an outsized influence in the global economy and financial services ecosystem, which was alarming because, you know, you knew that they were going to basically forcibly return capital to the U.S. investors. But the fact that they scrapped the entire project is crazy, right? So that's one extreme, but I would have thought that there would be opportunities for projects maybe that have already launched to do some form of remediation, kind of pay their slap on the wrist penalty, but ultimately, you know, continue to operate and continue to propel their networks forward because they're already liquid and outstanding and in many cases globally traded. What role do you play in that sort of process, and how do you think that kind of gray market or that messy market is going to evolve as we start to see more rulings and you know, more resolutions one way or the other with some of these 2017, 2018 token projects?
Yeah. So one thing I was sort of surprised to learn over time was so even traditional banks, you know, they screw up all the time. They screw up their KYC or they screw up how they're basically not able to follow the rules all the time. And part of the reason is they're just operating at such a scale that it's not possible to, like, mistakes are going to happen. Mm-hmm. And so it's actually very common for banks to hire different firms or to hire people in to help clean up. So something got screwed up because of bad oversight. And so they bring someone in, they clean up the procedures and the processes, and maybe they integrate some new technology. So what happened before with breaking the law doesn't happen again. I think in, so same thing happens in like crypto, but for different reasons, right? The past 10 years, these were all startups that emerged to provide infrastructure in the crypto space, the blockchain space, and some of them moved too quickly or didn't have the right experience or the right judgment. And so, things get missed from the compliance regulatory side. So occasionally we'll get projects coming to us that need to, for lack of a better term, clean up or to reprocess all of their users. And so we've had a handful of these, and that's something that we just got thrown into doing just because we're good with the complex compliance sort of situations internationally, domestically. And so, so if projects do sort of screw up on the compliance side, we can, with our counsel and with the right guidance, evaluate that to see if we can help clean it up from a regulatory perspective. I think with things like Telegram, I think it's going to be interesting to see what's going to happen there. I have a hunch that they are going to launch, they're going to have another entity launch the blockchain. I think I saw something in the news about that. So what happens when Telegram can't launch the blockchain? Well, it doesn't stop other people from launching the blockchain, the same blockchain. And so it's going to be interesting to see if that's what their strategy is here, whether it's sort of a pump fake where they're saying, okay, we're out, but then someone else is going to come out with a blockchain. Mm-hmm. Sort of like Elon Musk with Tesla. Hey guys, I'm leaving California. I can't take it anymore. And then the next thing we know is he's sending everyone back to work. Sometimes I guess you'll see stuff like that on the market, but it'll be interesting to see if Telegram actually ends up launching.
This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Luca. Save money this tax season with Luca Tax, the only time-tested crypto tax software. Luca has listened to your feedback and now lets you calculate capital gains and losses, seeing the results using three different accounting methods side by side, all for free. You only pay if you want to see their detailed tax reports and submit your forms using their software. Luca supports unlimited transaction downloads from all major exchanges and wallets and helps you optimize your tax reporting so you can max out this year's refunds or minimize how much you have to pay. Luca wants to help Messari's Unqualified Opinions listeners save even more this year. So use promo code MessariTax and you'll get a discount. Much more importantly, you'll do your taxes correctly and stay out of jail. Download Luca Tax at Luca with 2Ks tax.com and save money this tax season. This episode is brought to you by Bitstamp, the original crypto exchange. 2011 is a long time. This is their third Bitcoin halving, and Bitstamp has been the preferred exchange for serious traders and investors all along the way. 4 million customers, including top financial institutions worldwide, use Bitstamp. Check them out because they've got some serious professional-grade trading technology, including a matching engine from NASDAQ, some of the best APIs in the industry, and TradeView, their advanced trading interface, includes live charting and deep analytical tools that are available on web and mobile. Bitstamp also delivers unmatched customer service, no robots, real live people around the clock via phone, email, and social media if you have issues, but you won't. Join over 4 million traders, download the Bitstamp app from the App Store and Google Play, or visit bitstamp.net/pro to get started. That's bitstamp.net/pro, and they're hooking you up with a discount for Messari Pro as well using promo code Bitstamp. This episode of the podcast brought to you by Crypto.com. We know times are tough. That's why Crypto.com is introducing three different measures to help its community with their new Crypto.com app and credit card. First, they're waiving the 3.5% credit card fee on all crypto purchases in the next 3 months. They're also offering 10% back when you use the MCO Visa card on food and grocery shopping. And as always, you can buy gift cards on the Crypto.com app for merchants like Whole Foods, Safeway, Burger King, and more, with 20% back on food and an additional 10% back on groceries. So download the Crypto.com app today. If you kind of look into your crystal ball, we talked about custody being one of the missing pieces. Just generally speaking, liquidity is hard to come by in some of these nascent markets, and for security tokens, I think you're probably looking at the markets where some liquidity is better than none. And you're probably talking about a target investor base that doesn't care quite as much about slippage on day one as they might in you know other you know traditional assets where there are healthy regulated exchanges. Over the course of the next couple of years, I mean, do you have a sense for what type of volume and what type of mix we're going to see on these exchanges? Do you think that we'll see SAFs or kind of private some of these privately traded assets start getting liquidity on these security token exchanges just in case if they're still treated as securities? Is it going to be stable coins? Is it going to be real estate? I mean, there's been a lot of talk. There's been very very few actual assets that have been traded and tokenized so far and had any liquidity to speak of.
Yep. So I think if you're talking SAFs, I think there are secondary markets for SAFs. I won't say where or who, but the problem with SAFs and putting that into a regulated environment is it's so gray market that it's hard to justify doing that. So if you look at a traditional a traditional equity round and are looking to plug that equity into a regulated institution, that's very easy. That happens all the time with SharesPost. And we just saw an announcement with SharesPost and Forge today as well. And so if you look at the real estate side, it's a little bit different because average transaction sizes are a lot higher. And so I think one thing that's going to be really interesting is sort of you're probably going to see the polar opposite of what you see in like crypto markets that are bootstrapping, where they try to pull in a lot of liquidity through market makers. They try to pump the price. It starts at a very low price and you can buy small amounts. And I think in the real estate and the private placement market, what we're seeing is much larger check sizes, 25K, 50K, 100K. And we're seeing transfers of that value happening. So I think if the right product gets to market, and we're going to announce something along these lines soon, that it can scale. And so if the right product does get to market, it probably can scale at those transaction values and that volume and do really well. And I think it's just a matter of execution. I think it's been really hard for the industry because they started from like ICO back when you're supposed to do the opposite. So we always started from regulations back. What happens traditionally? How do we work backwards from that? And so there's a lot of impediments due to that. And so I think we'll see the polar opposite. So I think the volume that you see will probably scale really quickly. There might be a cap at the end of the day. I think if you can merge traditional crypto with the traditional finance space, I do think that that's where you can actually start to see a much larger increase in terms of volumes, but that's maybe 3 years out before that happens. But in the short term, I think by the end of the year, you will see decent volumes that are trading and transferring between counterparties.
Well, when you say decent volumes, just give me a ballpark.
I'd have to do some math,
or try to put it in context, with the crypto markets or the traditional equity markets.
I think by the end of the year, I would like to see in security tokens at least like $10 million in volume, like exchanging hands, like on the super conservative side. Because if the space can prove that out, that will prove that like this can scale much larger. Because how many funds and asset managers are actually out there? How much real estate now with this market is trying to exchange hands? And that's a lot more than like 6 months ago or a year ago. And so I think that would be a great conservative target for the space. And then if anything better happens than that, then amazing. At least we have the core infrastructure to help it scale if we can hit that target.
And I mean, to give people a sense for 10 million, it sounds low in Bitcoin terms, but if you're thinking about the long tail of assets on crypto exchanges, last 24 hours in real time volume, this is Zcash, Dash, Paxos token, USDC are all around that threshold. So it certainly seems feasible. You got to get to 10 million before you get to 100 million.
The status quo right now is like 200, 600 a day. like dollars in security tokens. And so, well,
what's even trading, like BCAP? Like I can't name a single security token right now.
Yep.
What is trading?
There's the stuff on Open Finance and there's the stuff on T0. And on T0, I believe it's either Overstock token or Overstock dividend token, something like that. And then BCAP on Open Finance, but there's like four or five that are actually really trading, and the volumes aren't anything. So if we can hit 10 million, that's a huge milestone. Mm-hmm. It's not a huge number in the general like crypto space, but it'll actually show.
Has anyone created a security token listing page? Because this sounds like something that we should do. But I haven't seen anything, and to my knowledge, I didn't even really think aside from BCAP anything was trading. I guess T0 has their own dividend token trading on their own exchange, but I'd be curious to see the list because we could spin that up pretty easily.
If you do it, we would integrate it. There's some data feeds that we have as well that we could probably partner on.
We'll talk about that offline. I think there's a broader question right now about just accreditation rules in general and whether those are woefully outdated, which they are, and kind of what the path forward is for making other types of investing activity, non-traditional investing activity, certainly in the last, 40, 50, 60 years, more accessible to retail audiences. So how do you think about the evolution? We've heard that they're working on adjustments to Reg CF and Reg A+, where they kind of raise the threshold that you can issue each year and the amount of capital you can raise from different groups under these exemptions. How do those fit under the TokenSoft, suite of products? And are you focused on that, or are you focused on the bona fide securities that are not reliant necessarily in some of these exemptions?
So everything that we do plugs into exemptions into the US, or like I said, there's those two registered offerings. So once those get through, there's no accreditation necessary to purchase, right? So one way is to just go full IPO. Reg A, definitely a harder time getting through the door. We've only seen two get through there. And Reg CF, lots of activity.
Props and BlockSAC being the only two, yeah. Right?
Yep.
What did you take away from the Algorand props announcement?
The takeaway from the public
from props switching over to use the Algorand blockchain, and whether it had anything to do with the fact that they shared investors or Algorand was an investor. What types of issues does that create, if any, when you're talking about issuing securities tokens or Reg A plus tokens?
I can't exactly comment on that one. Very unfortunately.
Oh, okay. I'm sure I can tell from your facial expression that you'd really like to.
I'd love to answer every question you have.
we'll pass on that. We'll take that as a hard no comment.
So there's Reg A, there's Reg D, which requires accredited investors. There's other thresholds which are higher. And so you can close your sale off to just have qualified institutional buyers or qualified purchasers, whatever. And so they have to have 5 million and up in assets. I'm okay with those rules. Like, I'm okay that these sales are limited. And I don't think like making the accreditation requirements lower is necessarily a good thing. I think bumping Reg CF up to 5 million is a great idea. I think, that's definitely something that a lot of like 1 million, you can't really do much with at the end of the day. So like Reg CF for 1 million, just based on the amount of effort, and now you have to manage the investors. And so it's a big challenge. So if you want to do it, it's probably great from a marketing standpoint, but if you actually want to raise capital to do something and scale a business, the 5 million threshold is a lot more interesting. But then, our platform also supports jurisdictions internationally. The most we've done is over 50. And so From that perspective, like with international markets, from a US perspective, raising money internationally, the barrier is you have to meet those local requirements. So once you can do that, then that sort of taps into a much more interesting market as well. And so there's definitely a lot of different avenues. I'm okay with the current accreditation requirements. At the end of the day, if you don't have the assets to be an accredited investor, you can buy the hat at shop.tokensoft.io, and you can at least look like a accredited investor.
Awesome. I am interested to sample folks, you know, kind of throughout the industry, especially folks that are in a major city right now, right? So you have these token teams. Many of them are, the workforce is distributed, even if the protocol itself and project isn't. That's typically been less true for infrastructure companies, right? You know, you guys are in San Francisco or in New York. You know, most of the exchanges are in a major city, right? And once they get to a certain, you know, size, maybe they'll have satellite offices. But this has really blown that up, right? Like we're spending, you know, now months and months and months. And in some cases, we've got employees that will pretty soon be used to remote work and have spent more time remote with us than physically with us, right? It's tough to envision a scenario where, A, things go back to normal, especially in New York, in the next couple of months. And B, most of us have kind of gotten used to this. Like we've invested in the workflows. Like we've got a lot of this. We've done a lot of the like brain damage to actually get comfortable or make do with remote work. And it's like extremely difficult for me to envision a scenario where a couple months from now, like I'm just, you know, on the New Jersey Transit, you know, coming into the city every day with all the other commuters, all of us wearing masks. Into the same like, you know, petri dish of a WeWork, which was already shit to begin with. I just feel like there's like who's gonna actually put up with that right now? It doesn't feel like that, you know, is gonna be compelling for anyone in the US especially, just because you know, we're probably gonna get the worst of it here. And I wonder what that ultimately means. Not so much for just like future of work, but if that's ultimately going to help more crypto teams move international anyway, right? Or at least kind of expand their operations so that they have these different redundancies. So the companies that are not yet international, if this helps them do that, or this helps them branch into different states. Yeah, legitimately, not just putting like a PO box and, you know, in Hoboken versus New York City, like some do.
Yeah, I think those of us that do, you know, like to have the whole team together, I think we're just generally like more conservative. Mm-hmm. And that's probably why we go in that direction. If you're like crypto first, like if we were just running a blockchain project, everything was on GitHub and we're just tracking everything online. And there's no like business team or sales force needed. That's a very different dynamic. And so I think what this has proven to me, at least, is you can still run, you know, a business team and a sales force and still have that legitimacy even without an office. What made us actually get a nice, clean-looking, organized office in a tall building in San Francisco was at some point these investment banks started, like, coming to meet with us. And they had, you know, suits and cufflinks and all that stuff. And I was like, okay, this is never going to work if we're in a co-working space. We're going to need like our own office with like security and like all that stuff, with a conference room, a dedicated conference room and all those things. And so that's sort of what forced the change, was just like having that like quality facade. And you see, you look at the trade-offs. And so I think the stuff that happened with us is just efficiency went up. And so we ran the numbers, and depending on how you look at them, our engineering throughput went up like 3x since COVID. and communication is better. Everything being online first just forces very lucid thinking, very clear organization, very good communication. We hop on the phone whenever we need to. Sales hasn't gone down, it's gone up. And so I'm hoping that like perception of I think it's like hyper-focusing everything on actually like quality and delivery. And I'm hoping that like perception of like needing to have a normal office and having to like shake hands with people, like that's still important, I think, but hopefully that's downplayed a little bit and we can operate in a more decentralized way. And we can sort of execute like this because I'm super efficient like this. You know, I don't have to, there's no like random conversations that happen. I can just focus on my work and then actually get things done.
I also just have to wonder how much of a deflationary impact that's going to have on the economy, right? Like even in a perfect scenario where there was like a perfect V-shaped recovery, you're still going to have a massive dislocation in spending on both the business and the personal side because of this de-urbanization, basically lowering the need to commute, lowering the need to congregate, you know, 5 days a week in an office, and to do so in some of the most expensive locales in the world, right? No less. So you'll hear this with lawyers, right? Like, you know, move out of your fucking, you know, ivory towers. I don't want to wait in the expensive waiting room. I would rather you reduce your billable rate by $300 an hour. Yeah. And you know what? You can probably do that if you move out of this real estate and you can even pocket a little bit extra, you know, to boot. So I think that's very real. And, you know, that sounds good in micro, but in macro, it's tough to even contemplate how much of a deflationary and negative impact that could have.
I think
globally.
Yeah, I think it depends on like how fast the economy can adapt, because everything is going, like some industries were still analog first, like supermarkets, restaurants, bars, and so now they're forced to be internet first. And what do you have when you go internet first? You have better distribution. You can now access more people. Maybe you start locally, but you can, you know, branch out to the next counties over and over. And so I think if the economy can adapt in these analog first markets, I think it can do really well. Like Tesla, even though they're sending people back to the factory, they're still like digital first. Like there's a lot of robotics built into their like assembly lines and they can put them up really quickly as a result. And so I'm hoping it like provides that kind of a shift. So companies become leaner, they become more efficient, they get better distribution. And that's basically how like Amazon got so big. And so hopefully that like actually spreads and becomes more of the ethos of corporations out there. And if that does happen, if we do get better distribution, it could be that the GDP actually is able to stay, well, maybe I'm not going to get that excited, but it could be that the economy actually stabilizes after a while and is able to adapt. So I think it could be a good thing. It's going to toughen up a lot of the companies out there.
Agreed. I know and have a lot of faith in you as an operator, and it sounds like there's a lot of exciting stuff going on in the realm of securities tokens. Where can people find you and learn more about the company, Mason?
You can go to tokensoft.io to learn more about our services and what we do. Mm-hmm. You can also follow us on Twitter at Tokensoft Inc. I got called out last time internally because I plugged my personal Twitter, not my company Twitter. So it's Tokensoft at Tokensoft Inc.
What's the personal one?
And then my personal one is Masonic_tweets. That's Masonic_tweets. So you can follow us on Twitter, go to our website, and we'd love to chat with you.
It's interesting that you say that because I had the same mindset early on with Masari as well. And then at some point, we started recognizing two things. One, why the fuck wouldn't we try to start from the bigger base? And number two, most brands are like personal anyway. And you know, it's one thing if you have, you know, folks on your team that are basically like spending all their time tweeting and just like trying to, you know, boost their own brand, but it's not tying back to the company. But you and me can't go anywhere. We're locked in, man. Like there is no flight risk with those accounts. Like the two-bit idiot is going to live and die by Masari. And so we can, you know, shill as much stuff as we want for my account. And I certainly do. And I've invested in it because, you know, talking about, you know, in some cases an order of magnitude more impressions and you know whatnot. So you should chill away and encourage everyone else in your team not to. And if you want to use that excuse, you can tell them what I told you. You're not going anywhere. You can't, by definition. We're slaves to our own creations.
That's right.
Check out Mason and TokenSoft. Mason, it's always a pleasure. We're gonna sidebar as soon as we turn the camera off and try to figure out how to give people better information in real time to the securities token market. It doesn't really matter right now, but by the end of the year, you heard it here first, it will. 10 million in daily volume is the target, which is still peanuts, but it's something. It's something more than $600 a day. Mason, stay well, man.
Awesome. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
And for everyone else that's tuned in, listening, watching, whatever your preferred medium is, we'll be right back here in just a couple days with another Unqualified Opinions. Until then, be good, stay safe. Peace.
That's a wrap. Thanks for listening. New episodes of Unqualified Opinions go live weekdays at noon Eastern Time. You can follow me in the meantime on Twitter at 2BitIdiot if you want to continue the conversation or troll me. Otherwise, I'll see you next week.